From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Black food fact. Did you know that Disney's Princess Tiana from The Princess and the Frog, she actually drew inspiration from a real life person? And that real life person was Leah Chase, the legendary chef in New Orleans. She was known as the queen of Creole cuisine, and she was a big advocate for African-American art and, of course, Creole cooking. And when Disney animators were looking for inspiration, they stumbled upon her story and met with Leah Chase, and the rest was history.
How do we make change without being overt about it? That's been the question rattling around KJ Kearney's brain these last few years. His answer? Black Food Fridays. In April 2020, he launched the initiative as a way to support Black-owned restaurants. Since then, his cheeky, hilarious, and informative videos have found a hungry audience. Black Food Fridays has more than 100,000 followers on Instagram and 155 followers on TikTok. And earlier this year, Kearney was nominated for a James Beard Award. We asked him to join us to discuss the power of social media advocacy in our tech-driven world. Hi, KJ.
That was a beautiful intro. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Can you explain the goal with Black Food Fridays? How long did you spend thinking about it before you put it into action?
Man, to answer the second part of the question, maybe 15 minutes. Like, it took me 15 minutes to decide and then execute, you know, pull the trigger, get the email address, the whole nine, start the Instagram account. But in a larger sense, I think that Black Food Fridays, the concept has been around for a couple years. I wrote the proclamation for Red Rice Day in the city of Charleston, and that showed me that you can use food in a political way because food is political, but it's also a way to bring people together. So I hope to, through my work with Black Food Fridays, radicalize people, but in a way that's fun, in a way that they don't even realize it's happening.
What's your 9-to-5 job?
I'm a community organizer for a nonprofit organization called Charleston Promise Neighborhood, and I primarily work with neighborhood association leaders in some historically Black neighborhoods where we service elementary schools that feed into them.
So you mentioned that you made a proclamation about Red Rice Day. Tell us about that.
Yeah, 2018, I submitted a proposal for the city of Charleston to formally recognize the culinary achievements and foundations that my ancestors, the Gullah Geechee people, which are the direct descendants of the West Africans who were forcibly enslaved here in Charleston and beyond. I wanted to make sure that the city did a good job of recognizing that that foundation that we rest upon comes from my ancestors. Red rice is like the American cousin of West African jollof. We still eat it to this day. And so I thought it was a way to both bring recognition to this dish that I love so much, but also allow the city to formally recognize that, yes, it is a food city and the world knows Charleston as a food city, but that didn't come out of thin air. It came from the blood, sweat, and tears and the culinary skills of the Gullah Geechee men and women that were here in Charleston in the greater area.
And did that come to pass? Did the city go ahead and recognize that cultural significance?
Absolutely. It was adopted in 2018. And so Red Rice Day is the last Saturday of September here in the city of Charleston.
So fantastic. So you were raised in the Gullah Geechee corridor of South Charleston. Did you grow up aware of how special your culture was?
Man, that is a great question. Actually, I did not. I mean, in Charleston County School District, I'm a product of Charleston County Public Schools. It wasn't taught. It was not taught. The Gullah Geechee culture and heritage was not taught. It wasn't taught about, from a cultural standpoint, from, you know, how special the dialect is, the food, how we influence most of American cuisine, that Black culture as we know it in America started here. None of that stuff was presented. I didn't know that it was special until I went off to college. I went to an HBCU called South Carolina State University, home of the Mighty Bulldogs and Marching 101. And it was there that I learned about Gullah Geechee culture and how special it is.
You share a lot of interesting stories and facts about the role of Black people in American food culture. How do you decide what topics you want to address and what kind of research goes into a subject before you do a video about it?
The type of research, the research can come from anywhere, as the ideas come from everywhere. I read maybe 50, 60 articles a day. I'm reading, you know, multiple books at a time, watching YouTube videos. So ideas can stem from almost anything I'm watching. In terms of deciding what gets made into a fact or a video, excuse me, what it really comes down to is my interest. If I find it interesting, if I say, oh, I didn't know that, I usually use that as my guide towards whether or not I'm going to make a video on it. And it served me well as someone who isn't classically trained in history or, you know, historical research. I do the best that I can with the information that is available to me.
So it seems often for people very challenging to get a message across in bite-sized clips on social media. How are you able to do it?
I have a lot of practice, man. You know, in addition to being a product of public schools, I also worked in them for a long time. So I worked in an alternative behavior middle school and high school and elementary school. And so learning how to keep kids' attention is something that I was kind of forced to learn how to do. So you kind of learn from that environment how to distinguish the obvious from the important, make sure that the important facts are in there, and get it across as fun and as short as possible so they have a chance to retain the information.
So are your favorite and your most popular the same? Maybe share so we get a deeper idea of what you're doing.
Oh, man. Yeah. You know what? No, I would say that my favorite video and my most popular are not necessarily the same, although I love every video that I make. My most popular video by far is a video where I, in 60 seconds, talked about the connection between Black Americans and cognac. Why is it that Black Americans love Hennessy and other cognacs so much? There's a real story behind that. I would say one of my most, to me, my most favorite videos is when I discovered that the princess from Princess and the Frog, the Disney movie, Princess Tiana, that was based on a real Black woman in New Orleans, Leah Chase from the historic Dookie Chase restaurant in New Orleans. That whole woman, her persona, her energy, that was based on a real person. So that's my favorite video.
You're based in Charleston. What are your favorite businesses to receive the Black Food Friday hashtag?
Oh, man, you're going to get me in trouble. let me say this. I have favorite dishes at many restaurants. So on James Island is a restaurant on Folly Road called Gilly's. Gilly's is dope. They have a grandma wall. So if anybody brings a framed photo of their grandmother, they can put it up on that wall. They have a dish there called a soul roll, which is a deep fried egg roll with red rice, with pork sausage, pulled pork, collard greens, and pimento cheese. It's outstanding. Another restaurant that I like is called Hannibal's Kitchen. It's in downtown Charleston on the corner of Blake and Drake Street. They have a fried flounder, a whole fried flounder with a seafood rice. And then in North Charleston, we have Nigel's Good Food. They have these things called Geechee Wings with their own Geechee sauce, which is like a sweet and sour sauce. Not exactly like a Chinese sweet and sour, their own take on it. It's delicious, and those are, I would say, three of my favorite dishes at three at some of my favorite restaurants.
So in addition to your social media presence, you also have a newsletter called Who Made the Potato Salad? Just one of the greatest titles ever.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. One of your posts provides some background on Black History Month. Could you take us through a timeline of Black History Month, along with some of your thoughts on corporate performative acts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what a lot of people don't realize, or I didn't realize that people didn't know until I wrote this newsletter, was that Black History Month actually started out as Black History Week. And it would take some time for the steam, if you will, to be built up so that legislation could be passed to make it a month-long celebration. That just lets anybody know who's listening that, you know, big ideas don't always start off big. Sometimes they start off really. As far as it relates to performative acts by corporations, I'm pretty clear on my stance that I'm not really interested in trying to negotiate who is or is not trying to be really impactful, who's really trying to make change in their communities. What I do want to call out is these corporations that wait until the last minute. What it shows is a lack of respect, not only for Black creatives, but for the holiday itself, right? Like, Black History Month comes every year at the same time, yet my inbox and the inbox of other Black creatives, they don't start getting until the week of or the week or two before. You know, it shows that budgeting just shows that thoughtfulness is not there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I could just talk to you for hours.
You could. We should one time.
Definitely. That's KJ Kearney, the founder of Black Food Fridays. Follow him on TikTok and Instagram and subscribe to his newsletter, Who Made the Potato Salad? Such a great title. You'll find links to his socials on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, exploring the legacy of food writer Diana Kennedy, who recently passed at the age of 99. Welcome back to Good Food. A lot has been written about cookbook author Diana Kennedy, who died in late July at age 99. Her decades of research on the cuisines of Mexico earned her the Order of the Aztec Eagle, the highest honor the Mexican government bestows on foreign nationals. She was also a lightning rod for issues surrounding representation and appropriation. I'm sure that won't change as her legacy evolves. I met her virtually through her first book, The Cuisines of Mexico, published in 1972. I was besotted. Although I was only 19, I worked my butt off to earn money for a plane ticket to New York so I could take a class from her at the Peter Kump Cooking School. It was a foundational experience for me. Los Angeles Times food editor Daniel Hernandez wrote a personal remembrance of her. He joins us now. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Many of our listeners may know the name Diana Kennedy, but some will not be well-versed in her early beginnings. How did this British woman, with a reverence for Mexican food and culture, find her way to the country?
It's a fascinating personal history that Diana referred to frequently because it altered the course of her life. She served in World War II, in the Corps for the UK. She met Paul Kennedy, a correspondent for the New York Times, in Haiti. They were both there on a trip. She fell in love with Mr. Kennedy, and they moved to Mexico together, where he was stationed covering the region for the New York Times. So that was really how she got her first real taste of Mexico. When Paul Kennedy got sick, they had to go back to New York and care for him. He died in 1967, and right around then is when she decided to return to Mexico and sort of build a whole new long chapter of her life there in the state of Michoacán, Mexico.
As a white expat living in Mexico, did it take time for her to earn legitimacy before she rose to iconic status?
Well, people not from Mexico move there all the time and had been doing so. Obviously, the Spaniards with colonialization and conquest into today, modern times. So she was part of this general tradition. But it seems to me that Diana Kennedy also had an ambition. She wanted to share with the world outside of Mexico all of this richness and glory, as a word that she often used, in reference to the cuisines of Mexico. And she very artfully was the first, in my understanding, English-speaking writer who really dove into this universe of different recipes, different styles, different philosophies to eating and to food and to cooking, and obviously the biodiversity of Mexico being what it is, the range, endless range of ingredients that would inspire anyone, but really, really inspire Diana Kennedy and set her on this course of sort of charting in English that diversity of Mexican cuisines.
I remember when the book first came out, even the title was kind of revolutionary, the fact that she didn't call it The Cuisine of Mexico. She called it cuisines of Mexico. And so right then, it was a very different look at what most people had come to think.
Exactamente. I mean, Kennedy at the time was writing to an audience in the United States who was used to Mexican food and understood Mexican food, often mistakenly, sort of misnomerly read as Spanish food, right? But this was a world of combination plates of enchiladas, probably of tamales early on as well, and definitely tacos. And there was just kind of one national brand. So in terms of Mexican cuisine, she did point out that Yucatan cuisine is different than Oaxacan cuisine. And Oaxacan cuisine itself has, you know, 7 or 10 or 20 different cuisines within it. And so she also published a book called Oaxaca al Gusto, Oaxaca to Your Taste, which is also an exploration of all the range of cuisines there within Oaxaca. So a pretty remarkable, I think, career towards sort of setting herself apart from the kind of traditional expat who's just kind of laying about and enjoying life in Mexico, you know.
What kind of changes did she see in her adopted home country during her nearly 7 decades there?
So Kennedy became really interested in sustainability and ecological living, inspired obviously by the thousands of years of history of indigenous Mexicans sort of living close to the earth. So she really wanted to maintain some of the things that she saw, and she saw with great anxiety, that were disappearing. So I think towards the end of her life, she began to really just have a lot of worry and really a lot of rage, which, you know, I don't think we get to or are allowed to see enough from women. She really took it there, and she wanted the world to know that there was still a way to pivot and kind of live more organically, sustainably, and connected with the ecologies and the geographies that are around us.
So you got to spend one day with her at her home in Coatepec de Morelos. When did you visit, and did you leave with the same impression of her that you had before you got there?
Yeah, so I went in March of 2014. I was the editor of Vice Mexico at the time. And so we went out there, myself and a photographer, and she was kind of exactly what I expected in a way. She did not hold back. There was also something very kind of delightfully self-aware about her self and the kind of image that she was attempting to transmit. She still lived very modestly. Everyone knew her in the town. This is a town that's in the metropolitan region of the city of Zitácuaro. And she was just kind of like the crazy old, you know, gringa who lived in the village, driving her stick shift Nissan truck. She obviously grew all of her food on her property. And I was impressed by that. And to see someone who very intentionally was doing that for 30, 40, 50 years was very inspirational and impressive for me.
Did you have an opportunity to talk to her about what she thought about Mexican food this side of the border?
Yes, and this was one of Diana's kind of controversial points. She was very dismissive of Mexican-American food. And a lot of people on this side of the border, and particularly a lot of Mexican-Americans and Chicanos, did not appreciate her point of view and did not want to legitimize the fact that she was writing in English, writing all these extensive cookbooks, collecting or slash borrowing or slash some would say appropriating recipes. So she dismissed Mexican-American food. And I think I would disagree with her on that. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, and this is probably uncomfortable to hear, probably like a good amount of Mexicans in Mexico would probably also, even in the year 2022, dismiss Mexican-American or north of the border Mexican food.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you.
That was LA Times food editor Daniel Hernandez talking about the life and legacy of Diana Kennedy. Diana Kennedy also inspired Mexican chef, restaurateur, and cookbook author Gabriela Cámara, who owns Contramar in Mexico City. The two-time James Beard semifinalist had a close personal relationship with Kennedy. After Kennedy's passing, she wrote on Instagram, "Being close to you and actually knowing and loving you has been one of the biggest and happiest honors and blessings of my life. My deepest and infinite admiration. Thank you for letting me be your family. What a joy it has been to be in your presence and your guidance all these years. Gabriela, when I read that on your Instagram, I have to tell you, it brought me to tears.
Oh, it's bringing me to tears to hear you read it. I hadn't heard it that way since I wrote it and was tearing up while I wrote it, but I'm really happy I wrote that.
How did you first meet Diana Kennedy, and how long ago was it?
It was about a little bit under 20 years ago. I was at the restaurant and they called me and they told me, I am bringing Diana Kennedy, this friend who had a publishing company. He said, I'm bringing Diana Kennedy because I'm making a book with her. I was like, oh my goodness, because of course I knew everything about Diana and I had used her cookbooks and I was a massive fan of Diana's. And she called me at the end of the meal and she had a really happy face and she announced that she had loved the food and she had found the food, the most exciting and delicious food that she had tasted in any modern restaurant or something like that, or in any of the new restaurants. And she from there decided she wanted to be my friend. She was lovely and she was always super critical. She was fierce as a critic. We built a really honest friendship and she, as enthusiastic as she was that time, other times she would just say, oh, this is not right because of this and this and this. And oh, this is, you know, this is lacking in this and the salt and oh, the bread needs more fermentation. And the why do you not put more salt on the crust of the pie? And like all of these things.
Were you allowed to push back? Were you allowed to be honest to her?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, we had a really good friendship. I think that's why we had a good friendship. We had a rule. We never suffered in silence and we never kept anything that we needed to say to each other to ourselves. No, we had arguments. People would be shocked at how I would tell her what I was thinking always. They're like, how do you dare? Like, she would have killed me and she doesn't say anything to you.
There was a lot of trust in the relationship, it sounds like.
I guess I was always her fan, but I was never intimidated by her
prickliness?
Yeah, her prickliness and her great knowledge of so many things. I always really admired her, and I think she knew that.
Tell me a little bit about the time that you two spent together. Did you travel together? Did you cook together? Did you stay at each other's homes?
You know, we did a lot. She immediately invited me to Quinta Diana, which was a very special place to visit, of course, because it was sort of a sanctuary of Mexican food. And she had had all these important visitors and she had this visitor's book that she always asked me to fill in. And she also stayed at my house and we also traveled together. She loved traveling with me. She loved tasting new things together. She loved going to new places. She loved coming to Mexico City and going to new restaurants with me and also visiting new places abroad.
What a privileged position you were in to be able to be a true intimate. I would love it if we could talk a little bit about how she was perceived within Mexico.
Surprisingly, she wasn't as known as one would think she should have been known. I think it had to do with many things. It had to do with her age. It had to do with social media. It had to do with the new wave of contemporary Mexican food. And it had to do with the fact that she was, for a very long part of her last years, very secluded up in Zitácuaro in Michoacán. I think this is something she always felt very frustrated about. People weren't really interested in learning about what she had to say. And she had a very prickly way of saying things and of talking about how she knew the recipe better and about how she had the real recipe for this or that. And she was, I mean, she had a funny relationship with food in terms of how it was supposed to be. And then when she liked somebody, she was also into innovation. But if she didn't like somebody, she would always argue that they're not doing the right thing. You know, oh, this is not, you know, this is not really a good chile en nogada. Good chiles en nogada aren't that sweet. Good chiles en nogada don't really have anything other than pork meat. Then when she went to Zitácuaro, she was much more known, say, in Texas and in the United States and in international circles than she was many times with young cooks.
Were her books translated into Spanish?
All of them were. She loved her books being translated. But I think her writing in English was so much better because that was her mother tongue. I love reading her cookbooks even before knowing her. I mean, she was a great writer.
Oh, definitely. Did the two of you ever have, you must have had conversations about her role as simultaneously being an influencer on Mexican cuisine, but also being a white outsider coming in? Did you talk to her about this at all?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. She was always so critical. And I think there's an aspect of her upfront criticism that was not appreciated, that didn't fit in well with Mexican ways. I think sometimes it was very difficult for Mexicans to relate to this foreign woman who was telling them what to do with their own heritage. For most Mexicans, food has always been a great treasure and a great source of pride. But it's only been until recent years that this knowledge has been sort of more generalized and that Mexicanness as a concept has been incorporated to high-end Mexican food.
Is there one particular dish that you, every time you make it, you associate it just absolutely strongly with her and it kind of makes you smile?
So many. And today I made crepas de huitlacoche. I made this because yesterday I was asked, you know, what dish where I could remember Diana with. And I made a point of making crepas de huitlacoche a menu item in the restaurant because I want this to be remembered as Diana's month. And I want crepas de huitlacoche on the menu because Diana was so proud of her huitlacoche crepas.
Thank you so much, Gabriela.
You're so welcome. It was lovely talking to you.
That was Chef Gabriela Cámara remembering Diana Kennedy, who recently passed away at 99 years old. In a minute, need an excuse to sip your favorite spirit? We'll delve into the medicinal origins of liquor. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. If you ever had a sore throat and your mom gave you a slug of whiskey with a wee bit of honey, who could blame her? Throughout history, alcohol and medicine have walked hand in hand. In his new book, Doctors and Distillers, spirits writer Camper English tells the tale of booze as a cure-all, from the doctor distillers of yore to present-day practitioners. Hi.
Hello.
This just seems like a perfect time to revisit this part of history, this intersection of medicine and alcohol. I expect many people have been doing versions of their own during this pandemic.
Yes, for better or worse, but it's largely been bad decision making on behalf of the homemade medicine crew during the pandemic.
So how long have humans been fermenting beverages?
Oh gosh, since before recorded history, humans have been fermenting beverages. Look at early civilizations. As soon as people settle down and stop being hunter-gatherers, there's evidence for beer production.
And then as time went on and societies became more organized, what elixirs became luxuries? And what did those hoi polloi partake of?
Well, it really depends on the part of the world where people lived. So if we look in ancient Egypt and the sort of Middle Eastern area, beer was the beverage, and it was the beverage for everything. And generally, any time large groups of people lived together, the water got polluted and was not safe to drink. So beer was the thing to drink because it was safer. And it was also, of course, used in medicine and as nutrition and hydration all at the same time. While if we look at the ancient Greek and Roman civilization, that's all about wine, which was more abundant in that part of the world. There was wine in the Middle East, but it came from further away, and that was more of a drink of the rich rather than an everyday drink that beer was.
Were there specific ailments that compelled people to reach out for fermented beverages as a cure?
Well, really, in the early evidence, when we see writing about cures that used fermented beverages, they were mostly used in the practice of medicine, not just like have a beer and call me in the morning, but with beer that might be infused with botanicals or sometimes animal parts. And some of the early cures look a lot more like witchcraft with spells and incantations. But typically the beer and wine was used as the sort of menstruum for medicinal botanicals, or just used like, you know, wash the wound with beer. They would specify that instead of water, basically.
And how soon were people specialists? I mean, not doctors per se, but like pharmacists for people. And what was the line that would go back and forth between like folk cures, things that were sort of in the women's realm that were maybe they were kind of called witches, and the men who were more kind of pharmacists?
Well, early on, pretty much everybody was a polymath because there was no concept of science and medicine as a separate discipline as we would see it today. So scholars of old tended to study astrology and medicine and mineralogy and all knowledge of the time. Specialization, while we see people commenting, people like Pliny commenting on specific uses for specific botanicals, they were also commenting on pretty much everything. I don't really have a good date for when someone became specifically only a doctor.
Can you talk about the notion of quintessence as it relates to alchemy?
The quintessence, yes.
Oh, quintessence.
Yes, the quintessence is the fifth element along with air, water, earth, and fire. And it was considered to be the active essence of the universe. Today, we might think of like a soul as sort of the individual personality of a person or something like that. But the quintessence was kind of like a life force, a universal energy. And the early alchemists were trying to extract that energy from people, but also from plants and other living materials, because they believed that that active essence was useful as medicine, and then that they could apply that medicine to people to cure them.
When we think of alchemists, we also think of metallurgy and metals. What about drinks related to metals, and even now, modern metallic drinks?
Sure. So yeah, that's the reputation of alchemists has, that they were trying to turn everything into gold. But what they were trying to do is to perfect each thing in its own nature. That was their line. And so they were trying to perfect people by applying quintessences, and they were trying to perfect, say, lead by turning it into gold, which was considered to be the perfect medicine. So if we take something like Goldschlager, the party drink of the 1980s, and look at that in the alchemical history, that looks like an extra perfect medicine, because people in the 13 and 1400s would comment on, if you extinguish liquid gold into eau de vie alcohol, then you would make extra special medicine. Still made today, there is a category of Italian bitter liqueur or amaro that is fortified with both quinine and iron. And it was advertised at one point as great for children. Give them a little spoonful each night to fortify the blood.
So you mentioned the word quinine. So let's go there. Gin and tonic is my drink of choice.
Excellent.
Can you kind of take us through the history of how quinine became a beverage that later became a recreational beverage?
Sure. Well, quinine is an active alkaloid from the cinchona tree bark. It's used to prevent and cure malaria. So that's in the modern scientific version of the story. Historically, malaria goes back so far that dinosaurs may have had the disease and the parasite infecting their blood as we do today. When I first got interested in alcohol and medicine, it was via the gin and tonic, because I thought I was going to find a better creation date for the gin and tonic by reading medicinal literature, which is far better documented than cocktail literature. So the first real cure, it was with Jesuit missionaries in Peru who learned probably from the indigenous people of this tree, the fever tree, and its amazing bark that would cure the shaking that people get when you have fever and chills. There was probably not malaria in this hemisphere at that time, so it was a great coincidence that it actually worked to cure not just the fever and chills of malaria, but the underlying parasite in the blood. And that allowed for, you know, all sorts of colonial expansion throughout the world, and particularly in the case of gin and tonic, for expansion into India and the need for quinine as a drug. So first, everyone was taking cinchona tree bark and whatever liquid they could find, because it is extremely bitter. Eventually, the quinine became known as just this all-purpose medicine that was good for everything. Sort of how we might think of electrolytes today. I don't know what they are, but let's put them in everything. You know, it sounds great. And quinine became that all-purpose wonder medicine of its day. In the 1800s, fizzy mineral waters in particular were considered medicinal as well and very good for you. So it was only a matter of time before the combination of that water with quinine came about as a commercial product. And that's where we get the tonic water that we know today.
And then gin itself had so much medicinal, I mean, all of those herbs and spices were thought to be various types of cures.
Absolutely. Pretty much, honestly, every spice and botanical that remains in our kitchen cabinets today was at one point used for something medicinal. And many of those things hold up. It's not the most effective medicine for most things that they might treat, but pretty much all spices were used as medicine at one time in history. Juniper in particular, which is the required botanical in gin, was used for a number of things, but particularly as a diuretic. One of the nicknames for gin, as it came about later, was diddle drain to help you urinate.
That's so funny. Alcohol is like such an absolutely groundbreaking element in the use of medicine. And I know that there were advancements in science that were made because of alcohol. Who were some of the pioneers in their field? And in particular, I'm wondering how Louis Pasteur used wine and beer in his research.
The two carbonated beverages, both carbonated mineral waters, like from natural springs, as well as fermenting beer and wine, really inspired a lot of chemical advancements and medicinal advances. So Louis Pasteur, his first major discovery was of tartrates in wine and looking at them closely with a microscope. And he came up with the concept that by their 3D shape of the molecule implied that it was formed from a biological process. And that observation led eventually to the germ theory of disease all the way there. First, through understanding that fermentation was a biological process, unlike the naturally fizzy waters that would come out of springs that had volcanic gases infused into them. And that division really set a huge revolution in science. It eventually led to the germ theory of disease.
So turning to our modern cocktail cabinets, what are some popular cocktails that we enjoy today that were originally created to soothe discontent?
Well, pretty much anything bitter was and might still be used to soothe the stomach. The categories of aperitifs and digestifs are based on bitter botanicals that stimulate gastric juices, essentially. They get everything flowing and make us hungry for a meal and then help us process and digest at the end of a meal. Bitter beverages include things like vermouth. Absinthe at one time would be considered an aperitif. All the Italian bitter liqueurs like Campari and Aperol to some extent, and then the digestifs like Fernet Branca were all somewhat medicinal, at least soothing. Those all still exist, as do the concentrated bitters like Angostura bitters. And when those bitters were first used in cocktail format, that's the actual first definition of a cocktail, is a drink that already existed, but you add bitters to it. And that's what sets it apart from things like a sling or a julep.
It's really a fabulous book. I mean, it's one of those books that you can open up anywhere and find some totally engaging paragraph to read.
Thanks. I went kind of big on it. I wrote most of it during the pandemic and had nowhere to go and time to research it.
That's Camper English, an award-winning writer who specializes in adult beverages. His book is Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. An Italian hoagie, a classic Reuben, a take on a sloppy Joe dubbed the Sloppy Pepe, but make them all vegan. These meat-focused sandwiches are marquee orders at Los Angeles' first vegan butcher shop. Maciel Bañales Luna and Joe Egender are the owners of Maciel's plant-based butcher and deli, which just opened in Highland Park. Hi, Maciel and Joe. Welcome to Good Food.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much, Evan. We appreciate you having us on.
Joe, why don't you start by telling us a bit about Maciel's? Is your focus on deli meats and cheeses that people can buy to make dishes at home, or is it more on house-made sandwiches?
Both, actually. It is a butcher deli. So we have the butcher side with a case full of your typical deli meats like pastrami, turkey, salami, bacon. But then with Maciel being from Mexico and the shop having a Mexican influence, we also have Mexican ribs, chicharrones, chorizo. And then also on the butcher side, we have some cheeses that Maciel makes, a plant-based jalapeno cheddar and a queso. Soon we'll have aged cheeses like Camembert and blue cheese. And then on the deli side, we have 6 sandwiches that we make from our meats. So the classic Reuben with the pastrami. We've got the Italian that has the pastrami and the salami in it. We've got the Flores, which is our Mexican rib sandwich. And then the Sloppy Pepe that you mentioned is made from our chorizo and our queso. And then the Californian, which is our turkey and our bacon.
Let's start with the deli meat and cheeses. Do you have a particular plant protein that you love working with that gives you the kind of mouth texture?
The meats are made out of legumes, so like beans and chickpeas and vegetables. But we also use seitan, tofu, and in a lot of spices. It's very important for us that they are also quality ingredients and they have also a lot of protein, yeah.
You have a background in medicine and nutrition. Can you talk to us a bit about that and how important that scientific experience has been in creating these ingredients for you?
So I studied nutrition in my undergrad. After college, I was holding workshops to teach people recipes and how to cook healthier. So, and then I was thinking of opening my own office and having clients, but also I had a strong desire to go down the path of research. So I decided to get my master, and then I was studying natural compounds of food that they can potentially improve health. And then after that, I got my PhD, where I focused on obesity and energy expenditure. I took a fellowship position in New York at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where I was focused on the potential benefit of fasting and obesity and cardiovascular diseases. So for me, all this knowledge is important, you know, because then I can prepare these meats or these cheeses in a healthier way. There's a lot of plant-based meat options in the supermarket, but unfortunately, a lot of them are highly processed. I like to use real foods like beans, chickpeas, tofu, seitan, and vegetables. So I start creating my own meats at home. So that's the goal for us, you know, like to offer the same quality to our customers.
You grew up in Durango, Mexico, a very meat-centered eating place.
Yes.
Did you grow up vegetarian or vegan?
I did not, but I feel very fortunate because I grew up with parents who in many ways were ahead of their time. My dad was environmentally conscious even before I was born, and my mom made a lot of effort to cook healthy meals. So we did not grow up vegetarians, but we did not eat a lot of meat. There wasn't a lot of meat around.
Is there a product, something you're trying to perfect that you're still working on, but you haven't quite hit it yet?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I'm working on. I'm still working in my blue cheese made out of cashews. Also, I wanna have some prosciutto.
Probably steak is kind of the ultimate goal, I think, of plant-based butchers. I don't think we're there yet on anyone nailing the plant-based steak, but we're trying.
Can you talk about how you ended up in Highland Park and how you're incorporating the neighborhood's Spanish-speaking community into your business model?
So Maciel and I were actually in, like she mentioned, she was at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine working at and research there, and we were living in Brooklyn. She came to me one day and said, "What do you think about opening a plant-based butcher shop?" And as we started developing the concept and started doing tastings with friends and family in Brooklyn, we would have people come, and most of our friends are meat eaters, so it was a great test audience. And as we developed the menu and it became more clear that we wanted it to have a Mexican influence, we decided that LA would be a great spot for the shop. I lived in LA for many years before moving to New York, so we initially started out looking throughout the city, but I think in our heart of hearts, we wanted to be on the east side. We just started, you know, looking anywhere and everywhere. And when we found our spot on York and Aldama, it really felt right. For Maciel, she grew up in a very meat-dominated culture, and wants the Hispanic community and wants the Mexican community to experience more plant-based diets and healthier diets. Moving into Highland Park and being in a community that is really a mix of not only Hispanic culture, but also a vegan culture, those two things combined really kind of made for the perfect location. And really every day we've had lines out the door, and it's just been a very supportive community. You know, we have a menu that's in English. We have a menu that's in Spanish. All of our social media posts are in English and Spanish. It's important to Maciel, and it's important to myself as well to have the Highland Park community feel like it's a place that everyone can come.
Maciel, I mean, everyone in town who's been watching you get ready to open knew you were going to be slammed the second that you opened. What has been so far the most popular menu item?
For a few days, the rib sandwich was very popular because it was on Eater. But so far, I think it's the Italian sandwich and the chocolate mousse. Yeah.
We love the Italian, and it always did well, the tastings. But I think we always thought that the Flores, which is the Mexican ribs, and the Californian would be the most popular sandwich. And the Italian is just running away with it.
Right, yeah.
Tell us what's in the Italian sandwich.
So the Italian sandwich has salami, pastrami, vegan cheese from Follow Your Heart, arugula, tomato, onions, red wine vinaigrette, pickled cherry, pepper spread.
Sounds wonderful. It's been lovely having the two of you on. I'm so pleased that you're hitting it out of the park. And I know it's hard at the beginning when you have so much business to try and keep up, but I'm sure you'll find your rhythm.
We're getting there. We're getting there. Thank you,
yeah,
Evan.
Exactly.
We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Maciel Bañales Luna and Joe Egander are the duo behind Maciel's plant-based butcher and deli, LA's first vegan butcher shop. Find them Tuesday through Sunday on York Boulevard in Highland Park. Up next, a mild, sweet Italian pepper takes its place in the sun as part of a Japanese seasoning. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market, where Jillian Ferguson has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I am so happy to see Sunoko Sakai at the market today. Sunoko is a cookbook author, cooking instructor and longtime friend of the show. Hi, Sunoko.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So I understand that you are now selling some of your Japanese pantry ingredients at the Hollywood Farmers Market.
Well, it really started out, I have this old Oro Blanco tree that's about 50 years old that produces about 500 fruit at one point. I mean, we've pruned it down to so that it doesn't take over our house, but and I started making seasonal jams, and then I looked at all the peels, and I said, I didn't want to waste it. So I dehydrated, and I basically turned it into furikake.
Okay, furikake. So tell us what that is.
So furikake is a sprinkle. It's something that Japanese people have been using for decades. I mean, maybe the most common one would be like a toasted sesame seeds with salt. We call it gomashio. And it's very simple, you know, it's just two ingredients. But to that, you could add other things. And Japan is a culture of rice, and people were eating way too much white rice at one point in history. And there was a doctor who was trying to solve the problem of B vitamin deficiency called beriberi. That's eating too much starch, white rice. So he looked at sardines, at dry sardines, and pulverized it and used that as sprinkles on rice. And Japanese people love dried sardines. So that was a very clever invention. But to that, there were other like seeds and kelp and citrus and different combination of dehydrated ingredients to make this shelf-stable sprinkle. Mm-hmm. And that's furikake. So it has a food medicine role, which I never thought of it that way. I just thought it was good, you know. So I always wanted that furikake on my family table. And the furikake is not necessarily just dehydrated. It could be a wet furikake. It's like a pickle. But we still want to call it furikake because it's smaller than a pickle.
So I'm looking at your Sunoko furikake right now, and there's no kelp, there's no seaweed in it. Tell us what's inside this jar.
Yeah, this is a really simple one. It actually started by an accident. One of my assistants roasted a lot of sesame seeds, and then she took off for a trip. And then I started to notice that it was getting really, that sesame seeds were getting oily. And I said, oh my God, what am I gonna do? And I tried to dehydrate it. No, it was starting to become a tahini. So I said, I have to turn in this into wet furikake. So I got a big pot and I seasoned it with soy and I seasoned it with meating. And then I said, I want to give it some heat. So I put some chili peppers, hot chili peppers, but I wanted to give it some color. So I was at the Santa Monica Farmers Market and I saw Alex Weiser's beautiful Jimmy Nardello chilies. And I said, oh my God, that somehow, I mean, it's delicious, just roasted, but or even raw. But I said, I want to bring that into my furikake. So I bought like, you know, 10 pounds of it and dehydrated them and put it in. I wanted it to have a natural sweetness. And so that's what this pepper does. It's got a little bit of coconut sugar just to counterbalance. But I thought that it almost didn't need any sweetener because then, you know, the Jimmy Nardello's contributed to that sweetness, which makes me so happy. It's like East meets West at its best. Yes. And that's the way I want to cook and I want to eat. And I want to keep trying different ingredients from the farmer's market.
That was Sunoko Sakai. You can find her tomorrow and next week at the Hollywood Farmer's Market selling her Sunoko furikake. Dawn Birch is one of the farmers growing those Jimmy Nardello peppers that Sunoko just talked about. She's behind Florabella Farms, located in Three Rivers near the entrance to Sequoia National Park. Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
So the name Jimmy Nardello is one of the most intriguing parts about this pepper. What do you know about the story behind the Jimmy Nardello?
I do know that it was developed by a man named Jimmy Nardello, and it is the only pepper named after a person.
Really?
Yes.
And it's absolutely gorgeous. Sunoko was just talking about how the color was one of the things that made her want to use this pepper. Describe what it looks like for us.
It is a deep, vibrant red. It almost glows. It just catches the eye.
It really does, and it has this great subtle curve to it.
They are beautiful to look at. They're kind of medium, in between the size of bigger than a shishito, smaller than a zafferano.
What about the flavor?
Oh, the flavor is creamy, wonderful. What we do with them at home is we just blister them in the pan real fast and then put some salt on them and eat them as finger food. We plow through them. They're not spicy. They're just a lovely appetizer, and they're fun to eat because they're finger food.
Yeah. How do they compare texture-wise to shishitos?
It's creamier. It has less skin and more meat. And then the Zafferano, I'll call it the big brother. That is like twice the size of a Nardello. We prepare them the same way. We blister them and eat them as finger food with some sea salt on them. And they're even creamier.
I'm not familiar with that Zafferano pepper. Where does that come from?
Few people know about it. It's actually from Tuscany. And seeds are not really readily available. We got them through a friend, and we've been growing them for a few years. And they're very popular with the chefs.
Yes. It's funny, the Jimmy Nardellos have become more and more popular with the chefs over the years. And I've noticed this year that many more farmers have started to grow them.
That's why we have added the Zafferanos. We want to lead the pack.
That's great. Dawn, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was Dawn Birch of Florabella Farms. You can find her every week at the Wednesday and Saturday downtown Santa Monica Farmers Markets. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Jillian Ferguson, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Chrissy Van Meter, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. To make my favorite gin and tonic, I love London Dry Gins. So Tanqueray or Bombay Sapphire or Ford's Gin, with a splash of Fever Tree or Q-Tonic and a generous squeeze of lime. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food. Cheers!